Today in Studio 360, Paul Beatty's new novel, The Sellout, pushes pretty much every button around America's most sensitive subject. Does so fearlessly and hilariously.
When I did what I did, I wasn't thinking about inalienable rights, the proud history of our people. I did what worked. And since when did a little slavery and segregation ever hurt anybody?
I'll talk with the author Paul Beatty about writing one of the most irreverent books ever about race in America. And back when Beatty was a toddler in the 1960s, it was actually risky sometimes for pop artists even to mention civil rights.
Many of the gospel artists used that B-side to give a message of support and hope for the civil rights movement at a time when it was very dangerous to do so.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show, some of the world's most important ancient cultural artifacts are being destroyed and ransacked by ISIS and other Islamists in the Middle East and North Africa. And that has ignited a debate among museum directors and scholars and archaeologists about what to do with art and artifacts from those places. Should things that originated in those now war-torn places continue to be returned, which is a now routine practice called repatriation? The most outspoken and contrarian figure in this debate is James Cuno, the president of the J. Paul Getty Trust, the art behemoth that runs the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. And he joins me now on the line. Jim, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So in terms of museums like yours, Western museums, what are the rules governing the acquisition of ancient objects?
So the UNESCO Convention of 1970, a set of principles and protocols which countries voluntarily agree to, it has no status in law, and says that people, art museums, institutions, should not acquire works of art that cannot be proven to have been out of their likely country of origin after 1970. In other words, they should be out before 1970.
Right.
But what we're talking about with regard to ISIS, we should be clear, and it's kind of a paradox. On the one hand, ISIS seems to be destroying things which it claims to be idolatrous and should not therefore exist. Then it seems to be, if we can believe what we hear, selling
right.
the portable objects that can, to advance its causes in the world. So they're preserving some by sale, and then they are destroying others by destruction.
Should museums and organizations like the Getty be buying them from these guys in order to save them?
I can say emphatically that no responsible museum is buying anything that might possibly have come from Syria or Iraq for the reason of not wanting to support the activities of ISIL in any possible way. That said, these things are out of the ground, and what's to be done with them? There might be a possibility that these things should be taken into protective custody by responsible museums around the world until they can be returned to Syria or Iraq, or wherever they might have come from. That's a very complicated thing and something that has been discouraged in the past by UNESCO and other authorities, but still something that's worth a conversation.
Now, in terms of repatriation generally, we've now all grown up thinking, oh, this is the simple ethical thing. If somebody's taken a cultural treasure from somewhere else, generally meaning a Westerner taking it from the developing world, it should be returned. But you argue and have argued that the ethics are not so simple, right?
Life is never so simple. There's always greater complications than one wishes existed, but nevertheless, they do exist. The thing about UNESCO, it is, of course, an entity determined by nation states, and it responds to the claims of nation states and the claims of nation states on culture as nationalized. It tries to encourage the repatriation of objects claimed by nation states simply because they claim them, not because there is evidence that they have been removed illegally or inappropriately.
You have a kind of more idealistic idea, right, that, well, it may have started in Iraq before Iraq existed, but it's now all of civilizations, and we should both share it in an ideal way, and it's safer if it's not all if it's distributed in various places.
Yes, I do think that we have a stake in world culture. Everyone does. And that stake is to preserve it for the future, that it is our responsibility that we advance knowledge about it. We distribute it for safekeeping and for introduction to the world. And because encouraging curiosity about the world's artistic legacy is to encourage tolerance for difference in the world and understanding of the integration of the world.
Now that repatriation has become the default idea, it can seem that you are saying, and I am sympathetic to, oh, well, here in the peaceful West, we're the only ones who can really be trusted with all this precious stuff. So when people say, well, you're just a neocolonialist, what should I say back?
Yeah, that's precisely what I don't say, which is that 9/11 taught us that wanton destruction can occur in New York City. It can occur in the places in which we have the most confidence, but it's not likely to occur in all of these places simultaneously. I think that this claim that, and I'm not making the claim that it's safer to have these things in New York, safer to have these things in Paris. These are claims made by those who oppose my point of view, and then they characterize that as a kind of neocolonial enterprise.
Yeah.
First of all, it's not what I claim, but second of all, in claiming that, they're contradicting themselves because many of these people who make these claims are housed in universities which promote a regime of knowledge of a Western origin and imposed onto the current Middle Eastern and Far Eastern and South Asian cultures.
So you're saying,
cultures.
I'm not a neocolonialist. You're a neocolonialist.
It's an easy and promiscuous term to attack someone with. I want to also point out that the term repatriation is a loaded term. I mean, it's a term that's used and its origins are derived from the return of prisoners of war.
Right.
And so there, in the application of that term in this instance, it's promoting an ideological point of view that these things that exist outside the modern borders of the nation state are being held prisoner against their will as if they're humans.
Yeah, that's a very good point. As you make this case and have made this case, you are not part of the majority, certainly, in your field. Do you feel like you're persuading people?
I think it's an argument based on reason, and I think reason is what's persuading people that this is something to consider.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your interest.
James Cuno is the president of the J. Paul Getty Trust and the author of Whose Culture? The Promise of Museums and the Debate Over Antiquity. If you listen to our show regularly, you know that we're monitoring and nudging for listeners who resolve to tackle some big creative project during 2015. We've got a movie guy turned calligrapher in Washington State, a reggae DJ mom in Ohio, a diorama artist in Northern California, and Joseph Riedel, a young man who lives just outside New York City. He resolved to make a web series about his experiences currently dealing with his brain tumor. And it's a comedy. He's calling it A Good Sense of Tumor. When I last talked with Joseph at the start of the year, he was about to have surgery, and now he's with me on the line. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I'm well. So how are you feeling? How did the surgery work out?
It went as well as anyone could have hoped. My doctor, Dr. Sen, believes he removed the entire tumor. And with all the information we currently have, there's a very good chance that I'm currently tumor and cancer-free.
That's excellent news.
I'm getting on my feet again. Went driving today for the first time. So one step at a time, I'm getting there.
And in terms of this project, did the surgery and recovery, as I can imagine, sort of put it on hold, or have you been doing stuff?
It really did put it on hold. I wasn't able to really read or write for about 1.5 months afterwards. Just the amount of focus was too much for me to handle. It was a little discouraging, but I kept working on the behind-the-scenes production kind of stuff. I have a small skeleton of a team right now, and we're all very excited to get things rolling.
That's excellent. And I know it has been important to you. It was important when we first talked that you sort of write as you go and incorporate your experiences in treatment and recovery into the series. Have there been particular moments of the last couple of months that have stuck out as, wow, that's a good scene for the show?
Oh, absolutely. The first words I said after surgery are definitely ending up in the series. Long story short, I'm not a huge fan of the musical Chess, and there's been a lot of teasing of my sister going on in our house because her boyfriend's currently in a production of it. So I'm lying in the recovery room after surgery, and I can't really communicate with anyone. I just sort of squeeze their hand to acknowledge that I heard them.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister says to me, "And when you're feeling better, Joe, we can go see my boyfriend in Chess." And that's the moment when I mustered up enough strength to go, "No."
That's funny.
So, yeah, there's been a couple of moments where I can find the humor in things again, which is nice.
Now, in a case like that, will you go with Chess or will you go with a more obviously and widely known loathsome piece of theater?
I'm probably going to go with a more universally hated piece of theater.
Yeah. No, I think to get the laugh. And we could name that list, but I think you can find the right one.
Right, but I also don't want getting blackballed by any producers who may end up being an employer of mine one day.
If you're writing comedy, you can't worry too much about that.
That's true.
So what is your schedule, production schedule, writing schedule look like? What is the next benchmark for you?
Right now, I'm trying to cram as much writing as possible into the next 2 months. And it sort of becomes a budget game at that point. I think I'm going to try to just produce the first episode, the pilot, and throw it out there, see if I can get funding, whether I'm doing a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo. And then depending on what kind of money I get in, then that will adjust my schedule accordingly.
Well, it sounds like you're doing what needs to be done, and we will keep watching and reading and wishing you well and staying in touch.
Very much appreciated. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joseph, and I'm really glad to hear your Knockwood doing better.
Well, thank you.
Joseph Riedel lives in Croton-on-Hudson, New York, and you can follow his progress and read the script for his first episode at studio360.org. And if you're starting on a creative project this year and need a morale boost or some advice, join our Facebook group. Just search for Studio 360's Creative New Year's Resolutioners. Coming up, The Guardian recently called Paul Beatty America's funniest writer. When he was a kid, the African-American literature he was assigned to read in school was strenuously unfunny.
But it was really shaping this idea of, like, being black was about this experience, which, not to say that it isn't, but it's about so much more.
I'll talk with Paul Beatty just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. There are certain media artifacts we all associate with the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, the fire hoses knocking down demonstrators in Birmingham, Alabama, and songs like this one.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
But it turns out the music you think you know from that time is only a fraction of what's out there. There are hundreds of other 60s songs to which almost nobody ever paid attention until very recently.
Here's a freedom song for all your freedom fighters out there everywhere. And when you sing, remember the wonderful ones who lost their dedicated lives for this precious purpose and won't be around to see it through. Now sing. Sing, every one of you.
Well, sometime I wonder,
is there freedom in this world?
Richard Paul explains.
The thing that made it possible for the civil rights music to disappear is a small little plastic disc with a big hole in the middle of it, something called a 45 RPM record.
We all praise him, Martin Luther King. Yes, we all praise him. Martin Luther King.
45s were the MP3s of their time, maybe 50 cents to buy and really cheap to make. Today, we think that anyone can just record a song and get it out to the world. Turns out, you could do it 60 years ago, too. Bob Darden is a professor at Baylor University. Back in the day, he says, on any city street corner in America,
there was a small little studio where you could go in with your group and sing a song, or maybe two.
For $50, the owner would give you 50 copies that you could sell after a concert or out the back of your car. Now, every 45 had two sides.
One song was designated for radio airplay. That was the A side. That was the side DJs were given and promoted and asked to play.
The B side, though, no one ever paid attention to. Quick, what's on the B side of Louie Louie? See? What's on the B side of Sounds of Silence? No one knows. And that's the secret. This hidden music was sung by sacred music performers, but these weren't church songs. What Bob Darden discovered by listening to long-discarded gospel 45s is that on record after record, the A-side is a religious message, the B-side is 100% political.
Many of the gospel artists we are just now discovering use that B-side to give a message of support and hope for the civil rights movement at a time when it was very dangerous to do so.
They've been ran over by horses and been by dogs through the suffering they still can slide.
Bob made this startling discovery when he first started Baylor's Black Gospel Music Restoration Project, which today, with 25,000 recordings digitized, is the largest collection of gospel music in the world. The songs come from old records, cassette tapes, and 8-tracks. Bob got them from people like Ramona Curtis.
I have to tell you, I love contemporary music, but if you're not going to sing a hymn on Sunday morning, I don't want to be in your service.
She's a Methodist churchgoer whose minister father collected all manner of gospel records.
Whenever I hear the old school gospel music, I really do remember Sunday mornings, the smell of coffee and bacon to the nose. But to the ears, it was always gospel music. The Dixie Hummingbirds, the Voices of Tabernacle, Reverend Leo Daniels, that music to me gives me strength.
Along with her father's collection, she also gave Bob one-of-a-kind recordings, like the album put out by the Voices of Christ Choir. She sang with them as an undergraduate at the University of Texas, Arlington.
The way I grew up, you know, we were singing, "Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim through this barren land." These aren't just worship songs. There are stories about struggle, about freedom, about knowing where your help comes from. It's therapeutic. And so it's so important.
While Ramona donated LPs, what Bob mostly got were 45s. Thousands of these disposable, long-forgotten songs that families had stashed away over the years. A curator looks at a record and then flips it over. That's how Bob figured out that an entire class of songs had been hiding in plain sight for 50 years. Performers did this for a practical reason. Being a politically active African-American was dangerous. We all know about the physical danger, but that was only part of it. Dr. Brigida Johnson is a professor of music at the University of South Carolina.
If you had a loan and people found out you were politically active, sometimes the bank would either call for the loan to be paid in full or they would increase your rates. If they were found to be involved with the Freedom Riders or voting rights, they sometimes were evicted from their homes.
When teachers were seen protesting, they came back on Monday to find that their job had been ended.
Well, I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, I'm grateful to the NAACP. Well, they have my mother, father, sister, brother, and me. I'm grateful to the NAACP.
They addressed things like the good news and about going to heaven and salvation, but they also talked about things that were going on in the world, not just the afterlife, usually offering a spiritual or religious solution for those problems that people were facing back then.
There would be no segregation in heaven. There'll be nothing but peace.
songs were part of two venerable American traditions. One is the message song. Bob Maravich is a record collector and editor of the Journal of Gospel Music.
When recording was taking off, you would have country singers and a few sacred singers doing songs about topical issues like the Titanic. And this is particularly important because, that was how you got news.
And within that message song tradition, there's another distinctly African-American tradition, hiding messages inside of songs. Bob Darden.
Gospel music and the spirituals were one of the few avenues where African-Americans had their own voice, where they could say and sing exactly what they were feeling. Now, sometimes those words were coded to keep white people from understanding it. And other times they weren't coded, but because you weren't part of that culture, you didn't understand what the singer was saying.
He had a dream, and he wasn't alone. He didn't forget to keep moving on.
There is an unbroken line with many of these spirituals that were used in the same way in the 1840s and 50s as they were used in the 1950s and 60s.
Sending a message undercover, but just a light cover, so that anyone who wanted to find it, then or now, could do it, long as they knew where to look. For Studio 360, I'm Richard Paul.
You can hear some of those freshly unearthed civil rights protest songs in full at studio360.org. Our story was made possible with help from Arts Edge, the digital learning program of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. What would happen if a poor black neighborhood in South Central L.A. right now reinstated segregation? And what if it actually improved things, drove the crime rate down and the test scores up and improved the quality of life in general? That is the major premise of The Sellout, an extremely funny and actually kind of shocking new novel by Paul Beatty that reminded me of Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut. The Guardian newspaper has just declared Paul Beatty to be the funniest writer in America, and he is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Yeah, welcome. Thanks.
In this book, frequently, you for creative narrative comic purposes, engage stereotypes. For instance, the main character, Bon Bon, he is, among other things, a farmer, a black farmer, and he grows famously good watermelons, square watermelons, and good weed. So you take these black stereotypes and sort of double down on them for comic purpose?
Yeah, that's not for comic purpose, really. It's just kind of to think about what stereotypes are, what they really mean. And yeah, for me, it's fun to just kind of like start at this base kind of level, the way that we think and the way that we perceive people, and just try to expand that, like turn that around. Like, you know, you see these 360 cameras, like just try to spin around like these things that we think are, that some people think are truths or whatever. And see past the stereotype a little bit.
Right. No, and because you go so directly into it and then sort of come out on the other side, you are not retailing it as stereotype. You're doing something different. Yeah. I would love you to read a little bit from the book, if you would.
Sure. So, the characters in the Supreme Court, he's a little high, and the justices have entered the room and the proceedings are about to start.
And the case against him is for this thing he's done to reintroduce segregation and slavery.
Yeah, exactly. So he's kind of segregated a school. So he's in a little bit of trouble. He sort of owns a slave against his will. So he's violated a few constitutional tenets.
Yes.
So I'll start with that. The black justice moves in too close to his microphone, yelling into it, because although I'm seated only a few feet away from the bench, our differences are light years apart. He's demanding to know how it is that in this day and age, a black man can violate the hallowed principles of the 13th Amendment by owning a slave. How could I willfully ignore the 14th Amendment and argue that sometimes segregation brings people together? Like all people who believe in the system, he wants answers. He wants to believe that Shakespeare wrote all those books, that Lincoln fought the Civil War to free the slaves, and that the United States fought World War II to rescue the Jews and keep the world safe for democracy, that Jesus and the double feature are coming back. But I'm no Panglossian American. And when I did what I did, I wasn't thinking about inalienable rights, the proud history of our people. I did what worked. And since when did a little slavery and segregation ever hurt anybody? And if so, so f***ing be it.
That was Paul Beatty reading from his new novel, The Sellout. I was not surprised to read after I read this book that you've called Kurt Vonnegut an influence. Was that an early book? Did you read Kurt Vonnegut early and feel
yeah,
influenced?
I guess. Yeah, I did. I mean, my mom had a really good library, and we never had a TV, so I read a ton of stuff. But a book that I had read when I was really young was Breakfast of Champions, and it just, it still stayed with me, you know. And it just doesn't flinch, you know. It just says what it has to say, and it's really funny, and it's really smart, and really perceptive, and no. I just remember really enjoying reading it.
For those people listeners who have not yet read you, it's a similar that and other Vonnegut books have a similar stylized version of reality that you do.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing I've tried to do.
Yeah,
you know,
I understand.
But there's a lot of stuff that's just in my bones, and that's just one of them.
Was Richard Pryor an influence for you?
Oh yeah, there's absolutely no doubt. I mean, he just didn't care, you know. I mean, he cared deeply, but he didn't care whether you cared about the way he cared, if that makes any sense.
Right.
And the vulnerability, I think that's so important. Yes. It's another thing that, you know, makes us uncomfortable. And he was definitely a huge influence.
One of the characters that comes in for plenty of ridicule in this novel is this pompous intellectual named Foy Cheshire.
Yeah.
Who has published a bowdlerized version of Huckleberry Finn called The Pejorative Free Adventures and Intellectual and Spiritual Journeys of African-American Jim and His Young Protege White Brother Huckleberry Finn as They Go in Search of the Lost Black Family Unit, which made me laugh out loud the first time I read it.
Good.
It seems in general, both in this book and stuff of yours I've read elsewhere, is that in general, whether you call it PC or anything else, pomposity and pretension and vanity are your targets.
Yeah, that's. I'm glad to hear you say that. Actually, not everyone picks up on that, and that cuts across the board. And it's hard to talk about this without coming across as pompous in a weird way.
Sure. So it's public radio. Be pompous.
No. I mean, I don't want to say never, but I have a problem with being preached at all the time.
Yeah.
And because I feel like it's infantilizing. I believe in allowing people the freedom to make mistakes and to fail. And to not live the life that you think is the way they should live, which is, I kind of, in a weird way, I guess, why the country was founded, some of the tenets.
I was going to say that what you were describing sounds like the American way.
Freedom
to think wrong and fail.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just all words, and of course, but there's something about that I try to subscribe to. And even with my writing, you know, I try not to make it pedantic, you know.
Mm-hmm. I've read that you don't love the term African American, and I wondered why.
It's clumsy. Doesn't really roll off my tongue. It's
six syllables.
Part of it.
American. Seven syllables. Oh.
Yeah. Part of it is I grew up with black, and I grew up with learning how long it took to get to black. For me, black is really unifying.
Mm-hmm. You edited a book of black humor a few years ago called Hokum. And in the introduction, which was very amusing to me, you wrote about hating the earnestness of the African American literature you were given as a kid in school, and throwing away the Maya Angelou book you were assigned to read. Thinking about that, is that just what, you know, English teacher curricula does? Is it about a certain period in post civil rights literature that is deemed acceptable? Will it end? I mean, will your children not be fed such earnest stuff necessarily?
Who knows? I don't have any kids, but hopefully it's changed. You know, I'm kind of old. You know, seventh grade is a long time ago. And, you know, hopefully there's room for fantasy and satirism and all these other kind of things in the literature that you give young people, you know, just to see this. You know, but it was really shaping this idea of, like, being black was about this experience, which, not to say that it isn't, but it's about so much more, you know.
Right. Well, but you're no longer in seventh grade. And in this novel, you make a little fun of Toni Morrison and of teacher poets whose verse you say compares everything to jazz. Childbirth is like jazz. Muhammad Ali is like jazz. Philadelphia is like jazz, which again made me laugh out loud. I would think that passages like that must make you kind of, if not a pariah, black and your fellow black intellectuals and artists must go like, hey, what's this guy doing?
No, I think
they have a sense of humor.
People have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And, whether this is true or not, I'd like to think that, you know, I'm making fun of myself first, and I'm often ridiculing things that I like. You know, like, I like Toni Morrison. And,
yep.
You know, the book is really, in a large part, about creating space and just allowing this character just to redefine what segregation is, what this neighborhood is now. You know, just this, these really narrow things. And, you know, we just look at everything through these blinders. And that's, I'm just trying to pull those back, hopefully, a little bit.
In this book, you at a certain point make fun of the way politicians and pundits these days are always calling for a national conversation about race.
Yeah.
And write that race is hard to talk about because it's hard to talk about. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I don't know. But, just like – you hear this all the time. We need to come to the table. And I'm like, what table are we talking about? And the way that we talk about this stuff, and it's not just race, you know, but this, all these shortcuts that we use. And, you know, I'm not against talking and speaking in metaphor all the time, but when it becomes a euphemism, then I have a problem.
I would think Hollywood would have sniffed around you, given that, you know, you're a funny writer. Do you have any interest in writing TV or movies?
Yeah, I think I would love to give it a shot. You know, I've, you know, done a couple little things, but I realize, you know, you need to be around good people and people who say what they mean. And it's something that I think about every now and then.
Good. But you're going to keep writing novels, I hope.
Yeah, we'll see.
Good. Paul Beatty, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, man.
Paul Beatty's latest novel, The Sellout, is available now. Still ahead this hour, Stephen Hull is one of today's most talented and productive American architects. And he says he learned everything he knows about light and form from a certain 2,000-year-old building.
I would go every day and go into the Pantheon. I had an agreement with the guards. You could tell the changing of the seasons by just going in there every day.
That is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. The best-known first line from a not-so-well-known novel is one of my favorites. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. Such as in the 1960s on Madison Avenue, the very exotic foreign country depicted for the last 8 years on Mad Men, the last chapter of which starts this weekend.
Can you believe it?
Happens all the time. They're all just between marriages, you know that. I'll probably make her a copywriter.
That is a scene from the fourth season where Peggy and the show's other female lead, the office manager Joan, find out that Don Draper has just gotten engaged to his secretary.
You know, I just saved this company. I signed the first new business since Lucky Strike left. But it's not as important as getting married. Again.
Well, I was just made director of agency operations. A title, no money, of course. And if they poured champagne, it must have been while I was pushing the mail cart.
A pretty face comes along, and everything goes out the window.
As the seasons go on, Peggy finds out that the times are a-changing, and she succeeds. So, in real life, did Jane Moss, who started out as a young advertising copywriter at Ogilvy & Mather in 1964 and worked her way up to creative director and then to the head of an agency, all of which she talks about in her memoir, Mad Women. She's here with me now. Jane Moss, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm glad to be here.
So in that clip, Joan says, oh, I got this title but no money. And does that conversation, that situation from 1966 strike a chord for you?
It sure does, because women were very often given titles instead of money, and men at that point were making about twice what we were making.
As opposed to just 30%, which is, I guess, what it is today.
Yes.
Did you bridle against that? How did that affect the work you did?
We just accepted a lot of this sexism as the way things were. A woman copywriter told me she went in to see our boss. We both worked for the same boss. And she said, Peter, who sits in the next office, is making twice what I'm making, and I feel I'm turning out better advertising more often than he is. And our boss said, but he's a man. He has a wife and kids to support. And she said, oh, I didn't think of that. And she never brought it up again.
There you go. As I mentioned, over the course of its 80-odd episodes, Mad Men has followed the rise of Peggy Olson, the young secretary who becomes a copywriter, who becomes copy chief. But it's not easy for her. Was your experience like Peggy's?
Well, I had been working on a quiz show called Name That Tune. So by the time I arrived at Ogilvy & Mather looking for a copywriting job, I already had credentials.
Right.
So they hired me as a copywriter. But a lot of women made their way up the way Peggy did, as working as a secretary first and then doing freelance, unpaid, speculative work, writing ads at night and on weekends, and finally getting hired as a copywriter.
Why did you seek to be in advertising? Did advertising seem like the place you wanted to be rather than writing television game shows?
Kurt, the going into advertising was the result of the rigged quiz shows all being thrown off the air. And so suddenly I was without a job. I was married to an architect. I had two kids. But working was terribly important to me. And I felt like a non-person when I didn't have a job. And so I knew there was something called advertising because we had advertisers on Name That Tune. So I put together a little speculative book, and I took it to Ogilvy, not Mr. Ogilvy, but the agency, and they hired me right that day.
And I guess actually thinking about it, this was like the very moment that Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique. So you there was some cultural support for you deciding that you needed to keep your professional bona fides, yeah?
Well, it was considered not done for a woman with children under
right.
the age of 12 to work full time.
That really wasn't done, right?
It really wasn't done. When my daughter was in first grade, there were only two full-time working mothers, and the school asked us, the mothers of the new kids, if we would hang around until 10 or 11 while the little darlings get used to going to school. And the other mother and I used to sneak out to go to work at 9:15, and the school thought we were pretty terrible. And men looked down at us working moms because they figured we happened to be married to bums otherwise.
Right. They'd support you.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. You were still a bit of an outlier as a woman in that kind of job?
Well, women were beginning to make inroads at Ogilvy & Mather because the agency had a lot of so-called women accounts. You know, Kurt, there was a kind of a ghetto. There were accounts.
Like girdles and makeup and detergent you could do ads for?
That's exactly right. But we weren't allowed to work on automobiles or finance or liquor. I guess men figured we couldn't balance our checkbooks, so we couldn't work on a bank. And obviously we didn't know how to drive very well, so cars were out. And liquor was something they used to seduce us, so we clearly—
It wasn't really your business.
That's right.
You talk about the Dove dish soap ads in the book.
A dishwashing liquid that thinks it's a hand lotion. You're Dove for dishes, remember? And you belong in the kitchen. Oh, I know. Washing dishes made my hands real dry. And then you came along and undried them. Oh, no.
Dove for dishes, the dishwashing liquid that thinks it's a hand lotion. Got dry hands? Undry them with Dove.
And the National Organization of Women gave me their very first award for the most obnoxious commercial of the year depicting women. The following year, I won the award again. I'm the only person in the
really?
World who has won the most obnoxious commercial
really?
Award twice
so
in a row.
You were a traitor to your sex.
But I sold a lot of Dove and a lot of Maxwell House coffee.
You tell a great story in the book about the campaign you worked on, and I remember these ads well, for Maxim Coffee with Patricia Neal. who was married to the writer Roald Dahl at the time, and he became involved. Let's play a clip from one of those ads for our listeners.
Actress and housewife Patricia Neal.
I love this hour. Children in bed, alone with my husband. Coffee tastes especially good now. We like Maxim because it tastes like perk coffee. Maxim starts with fresh percolated coffee. Then it's freeze-dried into big chunks of perk coffee. Coffee with character. I use Maxim because I think it's excellent. But more important, my husband thinks so too.
I haven't heard that commercial since, I guess, the late 1960s, and it seems to me very over the top. I sat here listening to it, Kurt, thinking, oh, God, did I write that? How terrible. How many times did she have to say fresh perked coffee in that 30 seconds? She was wonderful, a wonderful actress and a wonderful friend. Her husband, about whom she talked in every commercial, because that was the positioning of Maxim. It was coffee so good your husband liked it and would have a second cup. And so that bastard Rual, he's dead and I can say that, but he called me at one point and said, since I am basically an unseen presence in your commercials, I believe I should be paid residuals.
That's hilarious.
And I told General Foods, the client, that I thought we under no circumstances should we do that. But the campaign was going so well and everyone loved Patricia Neal so much that they knuckled under and paid Roald Dahl residuals for not appearing in the commercials.
That's funny. So James and the Giant Peach author, not such a peach, I guess.
Good.
What do you think about domestic product ads these days that are still mostly directed toward women? Have they changed? Have we changed in the way that ad messaging is done?
Well, I think we have changed. That we're not so blatantly sexist in the advertising. We don't show two women in the kitchen talking as though their marriages might end because they have
ring around the collar.
Ring around the collar.
Are there ads that are on the air today or in print that you think, well, that's great that they're still doing it like we tried to do it in the 60s and 70s?
I can't think of any.
Really?
Not.
So the golden age was the golden age and it's
yes.
over.
Yes.
Jane Moss, thank you so much for coming in.
I loved being here, Kurt. Thank you.
Jane Moss is the author of a memoir called Mad Women, and the final season of Mad Men starts this week.
Start walking.
You know those moments when you see a painting or hear a song or read a novel and you feel some kind of interior personal paradigm shift? At Studio 360, we love those moments. And the story we've got today starts with a work of art built 2,000 years ago, give or take. The work of art is a piece of architecture, the Pantheon, the truly awesome ancient building to which I make a pilgrimage every time I find myself in Rome. It is a model for lots of neoclassical buildings over the last several hundred years all over the world. At the top of its dome is a round window open to the sky, the oculus that lets in most of the building's light. For the great American architect Stephen Hall, that window was it.
I was born in the Olympic Peninsula, on the Kitsap Peninsula, across from Seattle. It's a sort of a hard scrabble, not very cultured place, but it's full of wonderful, big, gigantic Douglas fir trees and views of Mount Rainier and views of Seattle across the Yukon Harbor. I still have a cabin there. I just was there visiting my 94-year-old father. We celebrated his birthday. The cabin that we still have, when the sun rises in the wintertime, it's this glow. There can be days that it's so calm, the bay is like a mirror. And the sunlight is coming in at a very low angle, so it's reflecting in yellow ripples across this gigantic bay. And I grew up with that, and it's like mesmerizing. I was always interested in architecture as a child. I built with my brother a tree house in the backyard. In fact, at one point, my brother's a sculptor, so we always wanted to make things. And we're like, I don't know, five and six years old, and we would get so excited about what we're building in the backyard that we'd go out there in the summertime. We'd go out there at 5:36, whenever it was daylight, and my mother would call us in for breakfast, you know, a couple of hours later. We're out there working. And at one point, we had an underground house, which had logs and a rug and dirt over it. We had a two-story tree house and another tree house in, really up high. I think it had three stories. So we had all these constructions going on all the time. You know, it was kind of a natural transition to keep going with architecture. I went to the University of Washington, which is right across the Yukon Harbor. I mean, I didn't leave the Pacific Northwest until I was 20. I never saw anything, you know. And I got into this five-person study program in Rome and was basically airlifted from Seattle to Rome. Never saw the East Coast, never saw Europe, right straight to Rome. So that was a big shock. The thing that was such a shock was that the power of the architecture. It was so amazing to go into different churches, to go into different buildings. And there was nothing like that in the towns in the area that I grew up. The dimension and the beauty and the space of architecture in Rome is something it's just, for someone like me, there was a kind of amazing revelation. We lived at Via Denari 6, and it's a small street behind the Pantheon. And I would go every day and go into the Pantheon. I had an agreement with the guards. Just before they let the tourists in, I would go in, because I was a student, and study how the light changed. And it was enormously interesting because every day was different. You know, if there was a rain through the oculus, there would be these little silver elements where the light was hitting the rain. Or if it was a kind of humid day, there was a shaft of light. You could see the sunlight picked up in the geometry of the shaft. And then as it progressed towards summer, the oculus would project on different angles every morning. You could tell the changing of the seasons by just going in there every day. And it was just such an amazing space. It's like falling in love, you know? The Pantheon was, I don't know, it's from the outside, you just don't believe it. That can't be that important building. And the shock of going to the interior, the spatial energy of it, the material, the light. And that's something that goes back to one of my professor's statements. Architecture should always be more when you go in it than when you look at it. And there's no building that's more like that, you know, that possible reverse. And I always try to make my buildings like that. More when you go in them than when you look at them. Someone asked me what my favorite material was, and I said light. I really believe, in a certain sense, you can sculpt with light. And that probably the building that's more purely sculpted light is the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City, where we imagined even the pavilions that come out of the ground as blocks of light. And at night, they just glow like kind of almost like ice and reflect in the big reflecting pond as you arrive. And they form these spaces, these sculpture gardens between the pavilions. But when you're inside, of course, also the natural light and how it brings you through the gallery, how it draws you through the different gallery spaces. To me, that's really a key to making space that has this kind of spiritual depth and the excitement of you wanting to go through it. And then it changes, you know, it changes in the seasons and at the time of day. So I think that architecture should connect, like the Pantheon does, to the atmosphere, to the seasons, to the sunlight, to the air, to the wind. That's, to me, is essential.
That's architect Stephen Hall, designer of major buildings all over the world, including at the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City and the forthcoming new Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. Julie Burstein produced our story. Has some cultural work, very old or brand new, ever changed your life like that? Tell us at studio360.org and we might put your story on the air. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Tal Malad,
Jenny Lawton,
David Krasnow,
Martha Little,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hook.
Special thanks this week to Josh Rogerson. Our theme music is by David Van Tegel.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Singing, hey, hey, mama, can your daddy come home?
Next time in Studio 360, some advice from the country music superstar Dwight Yoakam.
Man can't really steal your field of wheat overnight, but he can sure take a lot of sheep, cattle.
Dwight Yoakam on music, movies, and agriculture. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Well, I'm a honky-tonk.